The Devil in the White City is a masterpiece of narrative nonfiction that has captivated millions of readers since its publication. Leonardo DiCaprio purchased the film rights, with Martin Scorsese initially attached to direct before it evolved into a Hulu series. The book spent years on bestseller lists, won numerous awards, including the Edgar Award for Best Fact Crime, and became a cultural touchstone for how we understand America's Gilded Age. Eric Larson's meticulous research and novelistic storytelling transformed what could have been a dry historical account into a gripping tale of human ambition and depravity set against the backdrop of one of history's most magnificent achievements. The story's enduring appeal lies in its perfect juxtaposition of light and darkness, the gleaming white city and the shadow of a serial killer, capturing a pivotal moment when America stood at the threshold between its past and future. In February 1890, crowds gathered outside Chicago's newspaper offices awaiting news that would determine their city's fate. The contest to host the World's Columbian Exposition, commemorating the 400th anniversary of Columbus's arrival in America, had become a fierce battle between American cities, with Chicago desperate to prove itself against New York's dismissive attitude. When Chicago won the congressional vote, celebrations erupted across the city. The fair represented not just an economic opportunity, but a chance for cultural legitimacy. The task of creating this monumental exposition fell to Daniel Burnham and John Root, partners in Chicago's premier architectural firm. Burnham, a failed Harvard and Yale applicant who had drifted through early adulthood, had found his calling in architecture after meeting the musically gifted Root. Together, they had pioneered Chicago's skyscrapers, solving the city's fundamental building challenge, its unstable, water-saturated soil, through Root's revolutionary floating foundation that distributed weight across layers of steel rails and concrete. Their partnership thrived on complementary talents, Burnham's charismatic client management and Root's artistic genius. Burnham created a remarkably modern office culture with a gym, handball, fencing lessons, and Root's piano recitals. But the World's Fair Commission would test them as never before. They faced an impossible timeline, just 3 years to build an entire city that would surpass Paris's 1889 exposition with its iconic Eiffel Tower. Chicago itself was a city of brutal contrasts. While architects created magnificent buildings downtown, poor neighborhoods were choked with garbage and animal corpses. The Chicago River flowed as a greasy plume into Lake Michigan near the city's drinking water intakes. Visitors found the city both awe-inspiring and terrifying, a gigantic peep show of utter horror, as one European visitor described it. Even Burnham, despite his love for Chicago's opportunities, purchased a home in peaceful Evanston, explaining, "I can no longer bear to have my children in the streets of Chicago." When Burnham and Root were appointed to lead the fair's design, they knew the stakes were enormous. As one critic warned, "Chicago is like the man who marries a woman with a ready-made family of 12. The trouble is just begun." Neither architect could have foreseen how prophetic those words would be, nor the convergence of forces, creative genius, natural disaster, economic crisis, and pure evil that would shape their creation. In August 1886, a handsome young man calling himself H.H. Holmes arrived in Chicago's Englewood neighborhood. Standing 5'8" with dark hair and mesmerizing blue eyes that a physician would later describe as very big and wide open, the eyes of great murderers, Holmes moved with confidence through the train station, drawing women's glances like wind-blown petals. He broke the rules of casual intimacy, standing too close, staring too hard, touching too much, yet women found him irresistibly appealing. Holmes quickly established himself by purchasing E.S. Holton drugs after convincing the elderly Mrs. Holton, whose husband was dying of cancer, that he could ease her burden. When Dr. Holton died, Holmes made the widow an offer to buy her store while allowing her to continue living upstairs. He financed it by mortgaging the store's fixtures and stock. When customers later inquired about Mrs. Holton's absence, Holmes initially claimed she was visiting relatives in California, later modifying his story to say she had settled there permanently. Born Herman Webster Mudgett in Gilmanton, New Hampshire, Holmes had a disturbing childhood. A formative experience occurred when he was 5 and older children dragged him, struggling and shrieking, into a doctor's office to confront a skeleton. Holmes later claimed this sparked his medical curiosity. But more likely, the boys discovered their victim didn't mind the encounter, that he merely gazed at the skeleton with cool appreciation, causing them to flee when his empty, pale blue eyes settled back upon them. After briefly teaching school, Holmes eloped with Clara Lovering at 18. Their passionate relationship quickly chilled as he disappeared for increasingly long periods until he simply vanished. At 19, he entered medical school, first at University of Vermont, then University of Michigan, known for its emphasis on dissection. After graduating with a lackluster record in 1884, Holmes devised elaborate life insurance frauds involving fake deaths and cadaver substitutions. He described acquiring and dismembering bodies as casually as if discussing firewood, calling them material and the necessary supply. In 1888, Holmes purchased land across from his drugstore and designed a building with retail shops on the first floor and apartments above. His plans included sinister features: a greased wooden chute from the second floor to basement, an airtight vault with asbestos-coated walls, hidden gas jets controllable from his closet, and secret chambers in the basement. To construct it cheaply, Holmes hired workers, berated their work regardless of quality, refused payment, and fired them, ensuring high turnover and minimal knowledge of the building's true purpose. By May 1890, Holmes completed his labyrinthine building with 6 corridors, 35 rooms, and 51 doors on the second floor alone. He opened a new drugstore in his corner shop and furnished his businesses with credit-purchased items he never intended to pay for, evading creditors through charm and deception. "He was the smoothest man I ever saw," said C.E. Davis, his jewelry counter manager. When Holmes learned in November 1890 that the World's Columbian Exposition would be built at Jackson Park, directly east of his building, he recognized a golden opportunity. The fair's location sparked a wave of speculation throughout Chicago's South Side, with nearby properties suddenly commanding premium prices. Holmes's strategically located building now seemed as valuable as a gold mine, and he began planning how to capitalize on the coming influx of visitors, particularly young women traveling alone. By July 1890, nearly 6 months after Congress awarded Chicago the World's Columbian Exposition, the 45 directors still hadn't decided on a location within the city. With dedication day set for October 12, 1892, and formal opening for May 1, 1893, Burnham knew time was precious. Only 26 months remained. Frustrated by the stalemate, director James Ellsworth visited Frederick Law Olmsted in Massachusetts, offering him $1,000 to evaluate potential sites. Olmsted, 68, partly lame, and plagued by various ailments, eventually agreed when Ellsworth described a vision far grander than the Paris Exposition. With his talented young associate Henry Codman, he arrived in Chicago on August 6, 1890, ready to begin work immediately. Though Olmsted personally preferred a northern lakefront site, he insisted Jackson Park could work beautifully, producing results of a pleasingly becoming character. He dismissed inland sites as flat, monotonous, and too far from the lake. In late October 1890, the Exposition Board appointed Burnham chief of construction with a salary equivalent to $360,000 in today's money. Burnham made Root the fair's supervising architect and Olmsted its supervising landscape architect. Though he now had formal authority to begin building, he still had no place to put it. On December 15, 1890, Burnham boarded a train to New York for what would prove the most crucial encounter of the exposition planning. He had secretly invited 5 prominent architects to join the exposition: George Post, Charles McKim, Richard Hunt, Robert Peabody, and Henry Van Brunt, none from Chicago. At the Players Club on December 22nd, Burnham faced these architectural giants, all wealthy, accomplished men with formal training that Burnham himself lacked. He described his vision for a fair grander than Paris, emphasized Olmsted's involvement, and promised complete artistic independence. Burnham returned to Chicago to find local architects and exposition board members outraged that he had courted Eastern architects while snubbing Chicago talent. Under pressure, Burnham and Root hastily invited five Chicago firms to join the project. Root then prepared to travel to New York for an American Institute of Architects meeting, though colleagues noticed his unusual fatigue when he complained about his workload, an alarming sign from someone who never complained about excessive work. On January 12, 1891, the Eastern and Chicago architects convened in Burnham and Root's library at the Rookery. Root was absent, and Burnham soon received news that Root had pneumonia. Root's condition worsened despite brief signs of improvement. On Thursday afternoon, Burnham visited Root, who asked him not to leave again. After briefly stepping away, Burnham returned to find Root had died, his last moments spent running his fingers over the bedding as if playing piano, whispering about beautiful music. Devastated, Burnham paced Root's living room, lamenting how his dreams for their architectural greatness were now shattered. Root's death stunned Chicago, with many wondering if the exposition could survive without him. Despite his grief, Burnham returned to work the following Monday, facing mounting challenges, including labor unrest and financial uncertainty. On February 24, 1891, Burnham, Olmsted, Hunt, and the other architects gathered in the Rookery's library to present their drawings to the Grounds and Buildings Committee. Each building revealed was more elaborate and immense than the last. Hunt displayed his administration building with its 275-foot dome. George Post's Manufactures and Liberal Arts Building would be the largest structure ever built, containing enough steel for two Brooklyn bridges. As daylight faded and gas jets were lit, Lyman Gage rose trembling with emotion. "You are dreaming, gentlemen. I only hope that half the vision may be realized." Sculptor Augustus Sungottis rushed to Burnham, declaring it the greatest meeting of artists since the 15th century. The White City was taking shape, but enormous challenges remained. While Burnham struggled to build his dream city, Holmes perfected his nightmare castle. In November 1891, Julia Connor, who worked in Holmes's pharmacy and had become his lover after her marriage to jewelry counter manager Ned Connor dissolved, told Holmes she was pregnant and demanded marriage. Holmes responded with warmth, agreeing to marry her on one condition. She must allow him to perform an abortion first. He assured her it would be painless under chloroform and they could have children later. As Christmas approached, Julia put her daughter Pearl to bed, promising St. Nicholas would bring wonderful gifts. Later, she helped her neighbor Mrs. Crow decorate a Christmas tree for Pearl and mentioned plans to attend her sister's wedding in Davenport, Iowa. Mrs. Crow noted Julia seemed in good spirits when she left that night. Holmes led Julia to a second-floor room prepared for surgery, instruments deliberately arranged to intimidate. After chloroforming her, he watched her struggle briefly before falling unconscious, finding intense arousal in her helplessness. When her pulse faded to nothing, he proceeded to Pearl's room with fresh chloroform-soaked cloth. Shortly after Christmas, Holmes hired Charles Chappell, an articulator who prepared skeletons for medical display, offering him $36 to clean and articulate a woman's corpse. Chappell, accustomed to working with cadavers from Cook County Hospital, saw nothing suspicious in a physician possessing a body. After Chappell returned the assembled skeleton, Holmes sold it to Hahnemann Medical College at a significant profit. In spring 1892, Holmes hired Emmeline Sigrund, a beautiful 24-year-old blonde stenographer from Keeley's Alcoholism Treatment Center in Dwight, Illinois, offering double her salary to become her personal secretary. Emmeline eagerly accepted, bringing her $800 savings to Chicago, enchanted by the prospect of living in the glamorous city during the lead-up to the World's Fair. Holmes quickly began his seduction, buying her flowers, taking her to the opera, and gifting her a bicycle. They often rode together to Jackson Park to watch the fair's construction. By October, Emmeline had become thoroughly infatuated with Holmes, even believing his secret claim to be the son of an English lord. Soon after, Holmes proposed marriage, promising Emmeline a European honeymoon. In early December, Emmeline visited neighbors in Holmes's building, bearing an early Christmas gift, a tin plate she had painted with a forest scene. When asked why she hadn't waited until Christmas, Emmeline explained she was returning to Indiana to spend the holiday with her family. She never said goodbye to her neighbors. When questioned, Holmes claimed Emmeline had left to get married. Days later, he showed a typeset wedding announcement for Emmeline and Robert E. Phelps, dated December 7, 1892. What no one knew was that Phelps was an alias used by Holmes's assistant, Benjamin Peitzel. That Holmes had enlisted Charles Chapel to articulate another female corpse in January 1893, and that inside Holmes's vault, a woman's footprint had become mysteriously etched into the door's enamel, possibly created when a victim stepped in acid and pressed against the door in a desperate attempt to escape. Holmes's pattern of murder emerged quietly within his castle. A waitress from his restaurant vanished without explanation. A stenographer named Jenny Thompson disappeared, as did Evelyn Stewart, who either worked for or stayed at the hotel. A male physician who had rented an office and befriended Holmes also departed without word to anyone. Chemical odors permeated the building, sometimes caustic like cleanser, other times medicinal, as if someone were administering anesthesia. Occasionally, the scent of gas filled the halls. When concerned family and friends inquired about the missing, Holmes responded with sympathy and helpfulness. The police, occupied with wealthy visitors and foreign dignitaries arriving for the fair, paid no attention. By spring 1891, Burnham lived full-time in his shanty at Jackson Park, rarely seeing his family despite the modest train distance. Construction finally began in July 1891, with Burnham inserting czar clauses into contracts, giving him absolute authority over deadlines and workforce. Despite many proposals to out-Eiffel Eiffel, including towers with rubber cable bounce rides and 4,000-foot structures, Burnham remained unsatisfied. Eiffel had already conquered tower building for France. Burnham meticulously planned for every threat to the fair's success. He established the Colombian Guard police force under Colonel Edmund Rice, emphasizing crime prevention rather than just arrests. To combat waterborne disease, he built a water sterilization plant and arranged for both filtered lake water and pure spring water from Waukesha, Wisconsin. Fire prevention became his greatest concern. Haunted by the Granis Clock fire, he created an exposition fire department with hundreds of hydrants, alarm boxes, and a specialized fireboat called the Fire Queen. Construction challenges mounted. When Chief Structural Engineer Abraham Gottlieb admitted failing to calculate wind loads, Burnham immediately halted work and ordered all designs strengthened to withstand the highest winds of the past decade. After Gottlieb resigned, Burnham replaced him with Edward Shankland, later facing criticism that the structures were unnecessarily strong. In January 1893, Chicago plunged into bitter cold, with temperatures falling to 20 degrees below zero. Burnham's dawn tours revealed a harsh landscape, frozen horse manure dotting the grounds, and 2-foot-thick ice contorting Olmsted's carefully planted bulrush and sedge. Olmsted's work lagged dangerously behind schedule, and his Chicago manager, Harry Codman, was hospitalized after appendicitis surgery. With only 4 months until opening day, the extreme cold intensified fire risks by freezing water lines and driving workers to violate Burnham's ban on open flames. Tragedy struck when Harry Codman died unexpectedly at age 29, devastating Olmsted. "You will have heard of our great calamity," he wrote to Gifford Pinchot. "As yet, I am as one standing on a wreck." Forced to take over direct supervision, Olmsted arrived in Chicago in early February to find Codman's desk overwhelmed with paperwork. Disaster struck when relentless snowfall caused the roof of the Manufacturers and Liberal Arts building to collapse in a blur of snow and glass. With barely 2 months until opening, a San Francisco reporter observed the stark reality. Only the woman's building is anywhere near completion inside and out. As opening day approached, Olmsted was deeply disappointed by the incomplete state of the grounds and wounded by criticism from others, even as clever as Burnham. The deadline remained immutable, as trains brought dignitaries from around the world, including President Cleveland and his entourage. 23 gleaming black carriages lined Michigan Avenue's yellow mud outside the Lexington Hotel as President Cleveland boarded the 7th carriage, with Burnham and Davis sharing the 6th, despite their unresolved mutual distrust. The procession rumbled south toward Jackson Park, followed by 200,000 Chicagoans on foot, horseback, and packed into every conceivable conveyance. The greatest miracle was the overnight transformation of the grounds. 10,000 men working through the night had removed debris, touched up paint, planted pansies, and laid sod as 1,000 scrub women cleaned the buildings. At 11 o'clock, President Cleveland took his seat on the platform as the crowd surged forward, causing 20 women to faint before the ceremony began. After brief speeches and a lengthy poetic ode to Columbus, Cleveland pressed a gold telegraph key at precisely 12:08, setting in motion the fair's massive machinery. Water exploded from the McMonnies fountain, banners unfurled everywhere, and 200 white doves leaped skyward as the crowd spontaneously sang, "My Country, 'Tis of Thee." Despite its incomplete state, the White City offered visitors a vision of urban possibility that contrasted sharply with Chicago's smoke-filled Black City. The fair featured clean public bathrooms, pure water, ambulance service, electric streetlights, and an advanced sewage system. The children's building provided daycare with claim checks for children. Only one child was ever abandoned, and none were lost. Visitors encountered revolutionary innovations, music transmitted by long-distance telephone from New York, Edison's kinetoscope showing moving pictures, and Nikola Tesla's electrical demonstrations. They sampled new products like Juicy Fruit gum, Cracker Jack, shredded wheat, derided as shredded doormat, and Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. The fair's vastness overwhelmed visitors, who bombarded Columbian guards with endless questions, some bizarre, like the woman who asked which building contained a pope. One amputee, tired of questions, told a persistent visitor his legs were bit off before hobbling away. As the fair progressed, skies cleared and flowers bloomed. The court of honor produced such majesty that some visitors wept upon entering. The building's shared white color created alluring effects as sunlight changed throughout the day, pale blue in morning mist, ochre at sunset. At night, the fair became truly magical, with every building outlined in white bulbs and giant searchlights sweeping the grounds. The fair consumed 3 times as much electricity as the entire city of Chicago, representing the first large-scale test of alternating current. For many visitors, like Polish immigrant Hilda Satt, these illuminations were their first encounter with electric lighting. As John Ingalls wrote in Cosmopolitan, "Night is the magician of the fair." Meanwhile, Holmes's World's Fair Hotel began receiving guests, though not in the volume expected. He strategically told male visitors the hotel was full while filling his rooms with young women unaccustomed to living alone, whom he found intoxicating. In March 1893, fortune delivered the perfect acquisition to Holmes, Minnie R. Williams, a plain, short, plump 25-year-old whom Holmes had met years earlier in Boston. Though physically unremarkable, with a baby face and seemingly limited intellect, she possessed something far more valuable, an inheritance worth between $50,000 and $100,000, equivalent to $1.5 to $3 million today, primarily in Fort Worth real estate. Holmes immediately resumed his pursuit, hiring her as his personal stenographer and installing her in rooms adjoining his office. Their romance intensified rapidly, with Holmes promising marriage, European travel, art lessons, and children. Meanwhile, he maneuvered her into transferring her Fort Worth property to Alexander Bond, actually Holmes himself, who then transferred it to Benton T. Lyman, actually Benjamin Patel, Holmes's assistant. Holmes, sensing Anna's growing suspicions about his dealings with Minnie, suggested that Minnie invite her sister to Chicago to see the World's Fair at his expense. Anna arrived from Midlothian, Texas in mid-June 1893 to visit her sister and brother Harry. The couple showed Anna Chicago's sights, including the Union Stockyards, where they witnessed the efficient but horrifying slaughter of hogs. At the World's Fair, they toured the magnificent buildings and attractions, with Holmes promising to bring them back for the July 4th fireworks. On July 4, 1893, Holmes, Minnie, and Anna joined the enormous crowd at the fair. As darkness fell, a black sea of people waded restlessly along the lakefront, massed 100 deep for half a mile. The crowd cheered wildly for everything, when the exposition orchestra played Home Sweet Home, when the palaces became outlined in gold, when searchlights swept the grounds, and when colorful plumes erupted from the MacMonnies fountain. Afterward, Holmes made an astonishingly generous offer to Minnie and Anna, promising a grand tour to Milwaukee, Old Orchard Beach, Maine, New York, and eventually Europe. The next morning, Holmes took Anna alone to tour his World's Fair hotel in Englewood, while Minnie readied her apartment for the next tenant. When Anna entered Holmes's walk-in vault, he quietly closed the door behind her and filled the vault with gas to ensure her death. While Holmes pursued his dark designs, a young Pittsburgh engineer named George Ferris was creating what would become the fair's most iconic attraction. Despite initial rejection and the Ways and Means Committee's reversal of their approval, calling his structure a monstrosity, Ferris spent $25,000 on detailed drawings and specifications that convinced prominent engineers to invest. In January 1893, Ferris battled the elements with dynamite to penetrate the frozen ground, then confronted the ice-cold quicksand beneath. His workers used steam jets to thaw dirt and prevent cement from freezing as they drove timber piles 32 feet down to reach solid footing for the 8 140-foot towers that would support his wheel. Though steel acquisition initially worried Ferris, his industry connections and inspection company proved invaluable in sourcing the 100,000 precision parts required. On June 9, as dusk approached, Ferris's wheel turned for the first time. When the engineer engaged the drive gears, loose nuts, bolts, and wrenches rained from the structure. Inevitable oversights from the 28,416 pounds of bolts used in construction. The wheel took 20 minutes to complete its first revolution. On June 21, 51 days behind schedule, the Ferris wheel officially opened to the public. The Iowa State Marching Band played from one of the fully glazed cars while Mayor Harrison, Bertha Palmer, and city officials joined Ferris on the platform. Ferris had created more than an engineering novelty. He had conjured an entirely new physical sensation. From the highest point, 264 feet above ground, passengers fell silent as the true power of the experience became apparent. "The view was so grand that all timidity left me," one writer wrote. "With the harbor dotted with vessels, the sunset casting gleams upon the scenery, and the entire park an intricate landscape of color, texture, and motion." The Ferris wheel quickly became the most popular attraction of the exposition. In early July, Ferris sold over 61,000 tickets in a week, earning nearly $14,000 in operating profit. Despite unfounded rumors of suicides and accidents, the wheel's safety features proved vital during emergencies. On July 10, as Burnham supervised repairs from a recent storm, smoke began rising from the cold storage building tower. The tower, lacking a crucial thimble component to extend the smokestack properly, had become a deadly trap. When firefighters led by Captain Fitzpatrick climbed to battle the blaze, burning debris ignited a fire in the space between the iron stack and tower walls. This created a superheated plasma that exploded when fresh air rushed in, trapping the men on the balcony. In the ensuing tragedy, 15 people died, including Fitzpatrick. A coroner's jury charged Burnham with criminal negligence, though many considered this an outrage. Despite these challenges, the fair's attendance began to surge. By June's end, daily paid attendance had more than doubled to 89,170 from May's dismal 37,501. Hotels filled from Englewood to the Loop, and the Woman's Building's Roof Garden Cafe now served 2,000 daily visitors. As October progressed, fair attendance rose dramatically as people realized time was running short. On October 22nd, paid attendance reached 138,100, jumping to 244,127 just 2 days later. 20,000 people daily rode the Ferris wheel, 80% more than at the month's start. On Chicago Day, October 9, 1893, the fair achieved unprecedented success. By 10 a.m., ticket takers at just one gate had recorded 60,000 paid admissions. Mayor Harrison had proclaimed a citywide holiday, courts and businesses closed, and perfect weather drew enormous crowds. By day's end, an astounding 716,881 people had passed through the gates, the largest single-day attendance of any World's Fair. The Chicago Tribune argued this proved Americans would support the fair if given the chance. Best of all, the day's receipts put the exposition firmly in the black financially, ensuring it would not end in debt. But tragedy would mar the fair's triumphant conclusion. On October 28th, Mayor Harrison addressed a gathering of fair officials declaring, "Look at it now, the dream of its creators realized." That night, while at home after dinner, Harrison answered his doorbell to find Patrick Prendergast, a mentally unstable 24-year-old who shot him 3 times. "Lock me up," Prendergast told police, claiming Harrison had promised him a corporation counsel position. The exposition company canceled the jubilant closing ceremony, replacing it with a somber memorial assembly in the fair's festival hall. Instead of jubilant celebrations, the fair ended with a solemn ceremony in the cold festival hall where an organist played Chopin's funeral march. At exactly 4:45 p.m. at sunset, the warship Michigan fired 21 cannon shots as 1,000 men simultaneously lowered all the exposition's flags. 200,000 tearful visitors joined in singing the Star-Spangled Banner and America. The White City's magic quickly faded as economic reality returned. The fair's closure left thousands unemployed, and homeless men began living among the abandoned palaces. By January 1894, the once magnificent buildings stood soiled and deteriorating. On July 5, 1894, arsonists set fire to the fair's 7 greatest palaces. From downtown buildings, people watched as flames rose 100 feet into the night sky. The Chicago Tribune noted there was no regret, rather a feeling of pleasure that the elements and not the wrecker should wipe out the spectacle of the Columbian season. Meanwhile, Holmes had fled Chicago with Benjamin Peitzel and his new fiancée, Georgiana Yoke, after setting fire to the top floor of his castle and filing a fraudulent insurance claim. In 1894, Holmes and Peitzel executed an insurance fraud scheme that went horribly wrong when Holmes actually murdered Peitzel rather than faking his death as planned. More disturbing still, Holmes took custody of 3 of Peitzel's 5 children, Alice, 15, Nellie, 11, and Howard, 8, and disappeared with them. Detective Frank Geyer, a 20-year veteran of Philadelphia's police force, took on the case in June 1895. Following a trail of hotel registrations and rental properties across multiple cities, Geyer discovered Holmes had orchestrated an elaborate charade, keeping Alice, Nellie, and Howard just 3 blocks away from their mother, Carrie, and siblings Desi and Baby Wharton in Detroit, without either group knowing the others were so near. On July 7, 1895, Geyer's investigation led to a breakthrough in Toronto. In the cellar of a house Holmes had rented, they discovered the bodies of Alice and Nellie Peitzel. The children had been buried nude, with Nellie's feet amputated, Holmes's attempt to remove evidence of her clubfoot. Later, Geyer found Howard's charred remains in Indianapolis. Holmes stood trial in Philadelphia in 1895 for Benjamin Peitzel's murder. Though District Attorney Graham brought witnesses from across the country, the judge limited evidence to only the Peitzel case. The trial featured grisly testimony about decomposition and chloroform, with Holmes showing remarkable indifference throughout. Carrie Peitzel's testimony about seeing her children's bodies in the Toronto morgue moved the courtroom to tears. Found guilty and sentenced to death, Holmes confessed to killing 27 people, though the true number remains unknown. Before his May 7, 1896 execution, Holmes arranged for his body to be encased in cement to prevent theft or scientific study. His grave in Holy Cross Cemetery remains unmarked, recorded only as 10 feet of cement on Lazarus Avenue. The fair had a powerful and lasting impact on the nation's psyche. It influenced Walt Disney, L. Frank Baum's Oz, Frank Lloyd Wright's designs, and established Columbus Day as a national holiday. Every carnival since has included a midway and Ferris wheel, while grocery stores contain products born at the exposition. The fair demonstrated that cities could be beautiful, not just practical. It launched the City Beautiful movement, with Burnham applying its principles to Cleveland, San Francisco, Manila, and Washington, D.C. After the fair, the key figures met varied fates. Olmsted's health deteriorated as dementia took hold. He spent his final years in McLean Asylum, which he had designed, lamenting, "They didn't carry out my plan." George Ferris initially profited from his wheel, but financial troubles mounted. After separating from his wife, he died of typhoid at 37, his ashes unclaimed. The wheel was eventually dynamited in 1906 after one final exposition. Buffalo Bill made $1 million but later went broke and died penniless. Theodore Dreiser married Sarah White but cheated repeatedly. Burnham himself lived only until June 1, 1912, dying of complications from diabetes, colitis, and infection. Just before his death, he had sailed on the Olympic hoping for news of his friend Frank Millett, who was aboard the Titanic. Burnham lost not only Millett, but also William Stead, who years earlier had warned about insufficient lifeboats on ocean liners. Burnham and his wife Margaret are buried in Chicago's Graceland Cemetery, near John Root, the Palmers, Lewis Sullivan, Mayor Harrison, and other prominent Chicagoans from the fair era. The Devil in the White City captures a pivotal moment in American history, when the nation stood between its rough frontier past and its modern future. The fair's classical architecture became controversial when Lewis Sullivan later condemned it as killing American architecture, though modern historians recognize it as awakening America to beauty and laying foundations for modernist architects. The White City represented America's aspirations for order, beauty, and progress, while Holmes embodied the dark undercurrents of modernity, anonymity, deception, and predation. Together, Burnham and Holmes represent two faces of American ambition, one building toward a dream of civic grandeur, the other constructing an architecture of death. Their parallel stories reveal how the same forces that created unprecedented opportunity and wonder in the rapidly industrializing nation also generated new forms of exploitation and evil. The gleaming White City and the sinister Murder Castle stood just miles apart, twin monuments to human potential for creation and destruction at the dawn of the modern age.